Welcome today to an interview series with outstanding professionals. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Dr. Joseph Turner, internationally awarded authority in computer science and education, fellow of the ACM, ABET, and CSAB, chair of the SoloCord, vice president and chair of the publications committee of IFIP, chair of the accreditation council training committee for ABET, and team chair for ABET computing accreditation evaluations. Joe, you bring a substantial history of significant and considerable national and international contributions to education, society, industry, and computing science to this interview. We are very fortunate to have you share your deep insights with the audience. Thank you.
And thank you, Stephen. It's always a pleasure to speak with you informally as well as formally.
Joe, can you discuss your prior roles and some key lessons that you wish to pass on?
Well, as you've listed, I'm very fortunate to have had active roles at many levels, local, regional, national, international. And these experiences have provided, I guess, different perspectives on similar problems and objectives. I've learned an awful lot, and I'm not sure how to narrow them down to only five, but I'm happy to share some of them in no particular order. The first one I'll list is one way of doing something might not work well in a different context, and regardless of how well it's worked elsewhere. There can be trade-offs relative to cultural or just other local contextual characteristics that can affect any evaluation or of overall success. And it's very difficult to take these into account in all cases. Second thing that I would list is what a person does or how a person reacts will be affected substantially, if not exclusively, by what is perceived to benefit that person, mostly in the short term. So we all tend to react in sort of a locally perceived context in terms of short-term benefit. So if you want to achieve an objective that involves actions taken by others, it's essential not only to communicate the benefits that are expected, but also to get acceptance and support for the process from those who will take actions that affect the result. You know, we always say you have to get buy-in from the users if you really want to be successful, and that's the basic lesson here. And it's one that it's very easy to forget, but it's extremely important. It's also important to bring in new ideas and perspectives when you're tackling a problem. This means usually bringing new people who haven't been previously involved with a group or in solving similar problems. Getting fresh ideas is really very important, and it's not always easy to do. But although fresh ideas are important, it's also equally important not to reinvent the wheel or to overlook history by essentially duplicating failed efforts from the past. I think we've all had the experience in an organization whenever new people come in, there's a certain amount of rehashing and going over things that have already been discussed and decided and tried and failed, but that's just part of the learning process, but still it's important to get those fresh ideas. Another important thing is that first impressions of people or situations are often and maybe even usually inaccurate. At least in my case, that is, there's always another side of the story, and it's really important to learn that lesson. The other side or other sides of the story may not be evident at first. People and situations are often not what they appear to be, and this goes along with having fresh ideas and diverse views, and the importance of that. One more thing is, we can always do better. We can always improve whatever it is we're doing. but the cost may not be worth the benefit gained. So the key is to be able to ascertain an improvement and then determine whether it can be implemented at an acceptable cost. And likewise, to determine when a potential improvement is not going to be worth its cost. Let's see, another one, every change, anything that's done can produce positive, or in general, will produce both positive and negative results. So it's important, again, for overall success, to recognize and to minimize or negate the negative results. Often, of course, the negative results are pretty negligible, and that's the desirable situation. But it's much more difficult to discern or determine what the negative results of something will be than what the expected positive results will be. We all react from our personal experience and our beliefs, which is one reason that a diverse group is really more likely to formulate a good, effective solution than an individual or small group of similar individuals would be. So this reminds me of a brief segment that I heard on in National Public Radio not too long ago about scientists who, these were social scientists in the particular context, who refused to implement the results of their experiments because they just didn't believe the results. And eventually the results of that experience turned out to be true. And so they missed an opportunity because their personal experience and beliefs made the results of the experiment seem so contradictory to what they firmly believed to be the case. And of course, in this particular segment of the news, the idea was that we all react in that way, and unfortunately, quite often, very important decisions are made by politicians and public officials and others on the basis of very strong personal beliefs, which may or may not be completely accurate relative to a broader situation. And then finally, I guess it's really important to know that perseverance and hard work and continuing to work on a problem can pay off. A lot of times it seems that there's just no solution, or all the solutions can be thought of are okay maybe, but not great. But if you keep plugging away long enough, you can usually come up with a reasonable solution, I think, to most problems. But sticking with it is becoming more and more difficult, especially with younger people now, I think, because we're all, and especially younger people, are becoming used to instant success and instant achievements. And you don't achieve important results instantly. So those are a few things. I guess I gave you a lot more than you asked for, but those are a lot of things that I've observed over a fairly long period of time.
You know, Joe, those are really valuable lessons. And, you know, there's one in particular that I kind of want to maybe ask you another question on, and that's sort of this idea of, you know, decisions are influenced by a person's experience and beliefs. And you gave a really great story of how that would manifest itself. So would you really relate that then to something like unconscious bias?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, we all have unconscious biases, I think, and that's almost exactly the what I was talking about, is that we need to rise above that, and that's just almost impossible, I think, in some cases. We're so ingrained with so many things, and much of it is we're not even conscious of. So I think that's a very good way of putting it.
Would you say, you know, in the U.S. you have a political situation where you have the first African-American president? Do you think there's some unconscious bias at play there as well amongst some segments of the population?
Well, I think there's probably unconscious bias about every president. And certainly, I mean, it's well, you know, it's well known there's a lot of conscious bias, certainly, toward people of different races, in particular African Americans, by white Americans, or, you know, a lot of Americans of different backgrounds. And I think that's certainly the case. It's not clear how much of a factor that is. Certainly it is a factor, and there are a lot of others.
Well, you know, I know that in your background you have a lot of cultural experiences, and we have a sort of a question that kind of sort of speaks to this, but I guess that, you know, it kind of relates to all the different things that you've done in your background, you know, traveling other countries and just seeing, you know, what are the norms, and then, you know, ensuring that you don't inject, you know, the norms from the North American experience into other cultures when you visit other countries as well.
Absolutely, absolutely, and that's one of the things that it's related to something that I said about getting diverse views and things that work in one situation may not work in another, especially a different cultural situation. And I've been fortunate from having lived in a different culture for a few years to really gain a much deeper appreciation for what that really means.
You know, Joe, you have this really just amazing, rich experience and background. Have you ever considered putting down some of your experiences in a book of some sort to share these insights to a broader audience?
I guess I've been asked that before, but I haven't considered it. That for probably a variety of reasons, I have. It's difficult for me to think of things in a way that would seem to be interesting and beneficial. So that's one of the reasons. But other is it just, you know, takes a lot of effort to produce a book, and I don't have the time now to manage the commitments that I've made. So maybe if I ever get to the retirement stage where I have very little to do or plenty of free time, I can think about something like that.
Well, I guess the podcast serves this purpose as well, right? So we get to mine some of that richness of experience that you have.
Well, thank you. I hope so.
So what do you consider to be your top contributions and achievements?
Well, not that I've made so many important contributions, but choosing a top three is difficult, and I probably would give different answers to this on different days. Thinking of my roles in volunteer positions, one that's current, I would have to say contributions to the establishment of the Seoul Accord, which is ongoing. A second would be contributions to establishing cooperation between the ACM and the IEEE Computer Society and curriculum development efforts prior to our effort that culminated in 1991. The two societies had been doing their own separate, independent curriculum recommendations, and there was a fair amount of, well, I don't know or whether saying fair amount is accurate or not, but there was certainly some significant opposition on both sides to trying to do something together, and a lot of people said it would never work. But we made it work, and it was successful, and other people, of course, contributed to that effort as well. But it was very satisfying, and in fact, that cooperation has continued even to this day. The curriculum recommendations come jointly between the ACM and the Computer Society, and other societies have joined in some of the efforts as well. And then the contributions that really I played maybe not a very large role in, because so many people were involved, but just getting accreditation established for computing programs in the United States was a very satisfying effort. So I certainly would have to consider that an important, certainly a satisfying experience.
You know, when I look at these efforts and that you've been involved with, really they mark historical inflection points and really make a significant imprint on today and into tomorrow. So really, I'm very much admire and respect all of this work.
Well, thank you.
What were the key disruptive forces driving change in your life, and how can we learn from your experiences?
Disruptive. Well, I'm not sure about disruptive, but I think of some events and some beliefs or guiding principles that have been influential, I think, in my life. Going way back to the fact that I went a reasonable distance from home when I went away to college, and that helped me instill the importance of open-minded and sort of analytical or independent thinking, getting out of context. Again, I guess it relates to something we've been discussing. It's very important to get yourself out of a comfortable context from time to time, and I think an ideal time to start doing that, if it hasn't happened earlier, is for college. I know that's very difficult. There are financial considerations involved, and it may be even more difficult today because of the cost of college education than it was when I went to college, but it was just an extremely good experience in terms of opening up, seeing different ways of thinking, different views that people had, and the reasons for their actions, which were quite different from the very comfortable and fairly routine, I think, context that I grew up in. So that was certainly a kind of initial experience that has affected a lot of things in the way I view the world and the way I've tried to react or to act since that time. I mentioned previously the fact that I lived more than just briefly in another culture, having lived 3 years in the Middle East. This reinforced knowledge that I think I really already had, but it certainly wasn't as strong. Knowledge that what works well in one culture doesn't necessarily work in another, and that value systems can be different without one being better necessarily than another. In other words, again, context is very important. And maybe most importantly, something that I sort of already had learned from chairing an academic department is there's more than one side or view of every story. And the side of the view that you get initially may or may not be the most accurate one. And in fact, there can be more than one, I would say, valid or useful opinion or view of different situations. Another thing that I've always, or most of my life at least, it seems that I tend to take the long view, or at least I try to, the view that it's better to do things that will have lasting or long-term benefit, that is, benefits tomorrow, than to do things that will produce more immediate results. And I think it's very important to do that. It's not always possible. We all have to put out fires, little crises that come up. We all certainly have to do the things that are going to advance us and make us successful, especially if you're supporting a family and that sort of thing. You have to do the things that are going to allow you to provide for your family, say, in a reasonable way, which often requires acting for short-term benefits. But thinking more about the future or taking a long view, at least for me, has, I think, paid off, and it's certainly more satisfying. And, well, finally, I guess it's a little bit trite and corny, but we should all try to make the world a better place. I think we have, in some sense, an obligation to do that. Certainly not everybody takes that view, but it's too bad. If we all had more of that view, certainly the world would be a better place. So those are a few things, I think, that have at least guided a lot of the things that I've done.
You know, in each of your current roles, what are the biggest challenges and their solutions?
Well, let's see, in the Soul Accord, just getting started, so the biggest challenge is for it to become well established and recognized internationally. Our vision is that it will become a leading authority on quality standards for post-secondary computing education. I don't know that I can say what a solution is. It's a work in progress, but since it's just under development, we're trying to, in fact, come up with some good ways to go about that. For the APIP Publications Committee, the biggest challenge, I think, is to improve the quality and recognition for the APIP publications. I think the best way to do that is to make the process and quality control mechanisms better and more realistic and easy to use. It's not something that has an obvious solution, and it is in process. There's already some good recognition, I think, in many parts of the world. No known solution, I guess, to achieve what we really would like to achieve at this point. But we're working on that. And then for ABET, for the training committee, of course, our goal there is to improve the training that provides good quality and effectiveness for the program evaluators and the team chairs, the people that actually do our accreditation evaluations. We're trying to do that by evaluating carefully the processes that we have, the quality of the evaluators that we have, identify the areas where there's a potential for improvement, trying to avoid, of course, trying to fix or improve something that works pretty well. And again, it's just a basic assessing what we're doing, making incremental changes, not trying to do too much that would be disruptive, because the process works reasonably well now. And so what we want to do is just make steady improvements where it's reasonable to do so. So there, again, these are all essentially works in progress. So trying to say what solutions really are is difficult, but those are some of the things that we're trying to do.
Now, Joe, I'm just going to maybe drill a little bit deeper into each one of these, the Soul Accord, the IFIP area, and the ABET area, because the audience may not be familiar with these three. Can you define a little bit about, you know, who are the members of the Soul Accord, and really how did it come about?
Okay, the Soul Accord is a the idea of this kind of accord is like a lot of international accords. It's an agreement among accreditation agencies in various countries for mutual recognition of the accreditation process insofar as it adequately prepares graduates of accredited programs for entry level, entry into a computing profession. So currently, the accord is just 1 year old, really, and we have 8 members from different countries, we will be sharing good practices and ideas and things that have worked and things that have not worked and that sort of thing. But the primary purpose is to establish some sort of mechanism that can be used to identify programs that could be considered substantially equivalent in various areas of the world as far as producing competently prepared computing professionals.
So now, with regards to IFIP, I know that they're a UN-founded body and really an official UNESCO consultative body, and I guess about, 50 years old, roughly. Can you define a little bit about IFIP itself?
Yeah, IFIP is the International Federation for Information Processing, and it is it's actually a the members of IFIP are computing societies, mostly one per country, except there are two from that are U.S. based, so it's just it's this consortium or this confederation of computing organizations that again are trying to establish or provide a forum and a way for cross-country cooperation and efforts to relative to computing, to information technology and our information and communications technology, of everything from common research efforts. There are a lot of technical committees and working groups in various research areas or specific technical areas of computing, and these are international in nature, and they hold conferences and produce scholarly works, which are disseminated by the through the IFIP publisher and other venues, and the publications committee is charged with the responsibility for coordinating and organizing mechanisms for disseminating these publications.
So I take it you'll be at the World Computing Congress next year in Brisbane, Australia.
Yes, yes, I do plan to be there. And we're looking forward to that. There will be, I believe it's 16 of the technical groups within IFIP that will be holding conference streams, almost sub-conferences, and they will be producing proceedings from each of those. So we will have several publications that come out of that conference.
And it's my understanding, since you're the chair of the Seoul Accord, that the Seoul Accord will also be meeting at approximately the same time.
Yes, the Seoul Accord has a what's called a general meeting, which is just a basic business meeting every 2 years. And in the off years, we plan to have what we call workshops or working meetings where we develop documents and processes and review what we're doing and have working groups on various problems. And we plan to hold that working meeting in Brisbane just before the beginning of the World Computer Congress.
You know, there's this other area of ABET. So again, for the audience, can you define ABET?
Yeah, ABET, and I should have done that sooner, same with IFIP. ABET is a, it used to be an acronym, but it no longer is. It's the name of the organization, it's just ABET. ABET is the U.S. Organization for Accreditation in Applied Science, Computing Engineering, and Engineering Technology. So there are, ABET has four what are called commissions that actually carry out the evaluation and accreditation activities for programs in different areas, the ones that I mentioned, Applied Science, Computing Engineering, and Engineering Technology. So that's the primary purpose of ABET. And ABET itself is the members, official members of ABET are again organizations, and they're professionally oriented organizations in the various areas that I mentioned.
Well, you know, again, I want to commend you on really all of these substantial contributions you're making to the ABET area, IFIP, and also the Seoul Accord. It's just, again, remarkable.
Thank you. Pleased that I've been able to do that.
Can you talk more about the accreditation of academic degree programs and how this work is progressing in the U.S. and internationally?
Well, accreditation, again, there's only accreditation at this point for baccalaureate-level computing programs in the U.S. And since it was started in the late 80s, the growth has been pretty steady and fairly rapid, and that even continues today. It's still growing quite rapidly. in terms of the number of programs, the number of institutions with that have accredited programs. I think it's had a very positive impact on the overall quality of computing education. Of course, I probably don't have an unbiased view of that. But it's caused many programs to strengthen in order to achieve accreditation. And so this has been overall a benefit to the students who are in those programs by giving them a better preparation and for the establishment of mechanisms to help ensure that the quality remains high and the program remains relevant in terms of its currency and the issues, the preparation that it provides. The integration with ABET, when computing accreditation first started, it was independent. It was not a part of ABET, and we joined ABET in about 2000. So, but this I think has been had many benefits, and because ABET was well established and recognized, and it's not resulted in domination by engineering as was feared by a lot of people when we first started talking about joining with ABET. So overall, I think it's been good for ABET. ABET has benefited by having computing accreditation, and there's been a steady improvement in the level of cross-communication among the various commissions and different disciplines that have been involved, which is always a positive thing. It's a little harder to say how accreditation is going internationally because I don't have a lot of personal knowledge there. I have probably a lot more than I did a couple of years ago because of the work with the Seoul Accord. Certainly, accreditation is going well in many countries, those represented in the Seoul Accord, for example. And it's my impression that many countries with good accreditation mechanisms in engineering also have or are considering similar processes for computing. But it's much newer generally in most countries than it is even in the U.S. And it's not very old, as I said, in the U.S.
So what are your views then on the education of computing professionals?
Well, in general, I think one of the most difficult things is to achieve a good balance between theoretical foundations and practice. It's difficult to know what is the best balance or how to achieve this. One traditional academic view has been that a good theoretical foundation is most important, and it leads to good practical skills, or the good practical skills can be developed later. But that just isn't really always the case. An industry sometimes expects more specific practical abilities or abilities in specific, say, tools and languages and that sort of thing, than can be achieved in a typical four-year program. So trying to find the right balance is not easy, and I think we still need some work in this, and there are certainly plenty of programs where the balance is off in either direction. One of the things that accreditation does is try to ensure that there's a reasonable balance, but it's quite often the case that the finding is that the balance is either too far off in one direction or another, or at least could use some improvement. One thing that's happened in computing education in the past year, 10 years or so especially, is a proliferation of new degree programs that focus on sort of hot areas and skills. This is done probably to attract students and to provide graduates that are targeted for perceived job needs. And it's not just in the U.S. I think, if anything, it's worse in, say, the U.K. than it is in the U.S. UK has literally hundreds, I think, of different names of computing degrees. But I don't think we're doing ourselves any favor. And in fact, I think it leads to confusion. And you just end up with, when the technology changes, if you have a very specific degree name and technology can become out of date, it's sort of like what's happened to programming languages, say, during the past. They come and go, in vogue and out of vogue and that sort of thing. So I think we have to be careful about creating so many new, not necessarily new programs, but new names of programs. And it would be a lot better off if we could just work on identifying core knowledge and skills to provide a common foundation for computing programs in order to be able, that we can have a small number of names that we use for our programs. And then within those programs, we could have specialties or tracks in specific concentration areas. And then, of course, again, in terms of generally the education of computing professionals, there's a lot of good information out there, and the recommendations of the societies for what should be in computing programs and the notion of core knowledge and foundational material, along with the accreditation guidelines, all of these should be considered in any computing program that intends to prepare its graduates for entry-level positions as professionals. Should consider all of these various guidelines rather than just trying to decide on the basis of their own personal experience and knowledge, because there's just a wealth of information out there. And people need to take advantage of all the things that have been done to try to determine what should be in a computing program.
You know, can you sort of give your views on international credentials for computing professionals?
Well, in general, there are two kinds of credentials for professionals. There's a diploma from a program that prepares its graduates to enter the profession. We could be more specific and say a diploma from an accredited program, which gives a little more status, I think. And then there's a certificate of achievement or licensure. These aren't mutually exclusive, certainly. Many people have both, and you can even have multiple certificates of achievement, certificates in different areas. Currently, both kinds of credentials are provided independently in different ways among different countries. But although some certifications in specialized areas are offered by computing companies, and these apply uniformly around the world. And there are also certifications offered by various organizations without regard to national boundaries. Some computing societies, and then there are a couple of organizations that exist for the purpose of offering various certifications. So the certifications are independent of academic preparation, although, of course, many of them are oriented to build on a standard kind of undergraduate or, say, preparation. Given the increasing mobility, we're seeing professionals who move around the world, and we have multinational companies, and the commerce is becoming more and more global. Because of all these reason, it would be beneficial if we had some credentials that could be compared across national boundaries. The Seoul Accord seeks to establish a kind of equivalence, at least a equivalence in terms of outcomes relative to preparation for professional practice. Similarly, IFIP, one of the things IFIP is doing is IFIP has organized a consortium of computing societies and with some industrial partners to establish a certification process for IT professionals that will apply across national boundaries. So I think it would be very beneficial if both of these kind of mechanisms could grow to become truly international and really recognized as standards, because it would give sort of a way for credentials that easily apply or transfer across national boundaries.
So it's interesting, Joe, you're talking about the SOLA Accord, which is this leading authority on quality standards for post-secondary computing education. And then complementary to that, you have this UNESCO body, IFIP, the International Federation for Information Processing, and they have their IP3 program, which is their International Professional Practice Partnership Program, which is about, again, global standards and globally recognized or internationally recognized certification. And then we have this World Computing Congress happening next year in Brisbane. Are the two bodies going to meet then, the IP3 group and the SOLA Accord group?
Yes. As we've already said, the SOLA Accord is planning a workshop meeting there, and the IP3 group, I forget what they call it, their council or steering committee or board, is also meeting there. And I believe the IP3 group will actually have a session or two or a role in the World Computer Congress. The SOLA Accord does not have any specific role, but actually the two organizations are getting together, and there will be a session during the first part of the SOLA Accord opening where there will be a joint meeting, a presentation by IP3, and some discussion about cooperative efforts that may be appropriate between the two bodies. Basically, the two are independent, but it's in a way it's similar to the way in which, say, in the U.S. with ABET, the accreditation standards are independent from the curriculum recommendations by the professional organizations. But of course, the professional organizations are also members of ABET, but it's important to keep those efforts separate, but they each needs to be cognizant of the what the other is doing, and certainly the goal would be not to contradict, and also to be complementary to the extent that it's reasonable to do so.
Well, again, it sort of marks a historical inflection point in the profession, society, the industry, and so on, where you have the SOLA Accord, this independent sort of group working on accreditation, post-secondary computing education, and then you have the IP3 program, which is working on sort of the standards for certification worldwide, and the fact that they're both in the implementation phases, and that's never happened before at an international global scale. It's sort of an inflection point, and you're part of these initiatives, or you're part of the SOLA Accord.
I'm part of the SOLA Accord. Yeah,
I think it's just amazing that this is occurring at this time, and I mean it's really good for the profession worldwide. So
I agree. I mean it's a very exciting time, and I think there's great promise for both of these efforts.
So I guess this kind of ties into this next question. Maybe we've already discussed it, and that is, how is work progressing on international standards for computing education, and what do you hope to achieve?
Well, in the SOLA Accord, the approach we've taken is, if you start trying to establish international standards, you immediately run into problems. Because the educational systems are different in different countries, different accreditation processes or agencies have different procedures. And so if you're trying to establish some way to compare or relate those different processes, if you try to do it in any kind of direct way, it just is almost impossible to do. So what we did in the SOLA Accord, and this was also done, by the way, in engineering accords, is we established a set of attributes. We started with this from the beginning because we felt it was really the only way to address all of the problems and to sort of bring everything together. And the attributes specify the capabilities that should be achieved by graduates of accredited baccalaureate level computing programs. So by, in a sense, specifying the final output, regardless of the processes or the what students go through to get to that point, but saying basically the capabilities, the attributes the graduate should have if they graduate from an accredited baccalaureate level program, we avoided the need to try to define equivalence of criteria or processes or standards for different accreditation agencies, and avoided having to address any difference in educational systems, the number of years at various post-college and during college and that sort of thing. So that's the approach that we took. As I said earlier, the Accord was established 1 year ago, and we currently have 8 members. So we're very early in our development. We're still busy doing a lot of sort of routine work on procedures and organization and just getting the basic frameworks and mechanisms established, but we're pretty optimistic about the future. We hope to gain membership from all recognized accreditation agencies for computing programs, and through our mutual recognition among ourselves and through sharing, we hope to improve computing education around the world. I mean, in some sense, you could say that's the primary purpose, is really to improve computing education. Of course, an important goal is also to provide a way to determine those programs in different countries that provide professional preparation that meet professional preparation that meets established minimum standards, which would provide some way to sort of establish a kind of an equivalence class of academic programs. So that's certainly an important goal as well. And as I said, it's very early, but that's I think a summary of where we stand, what the progress is, and a little bit about what we hope to achieve.
You know, and you've got the position as chair, which has a lot of work sort of related to it in a sense. And what's the term of your position as chair?
It's a 2-year term with possibility for re-election or succeeding. The terms coincide with what we call the general meeting, which is the official every 2-year primary business meeting at the organization.
Well, I think it's quite remarkable that you were willing to take that on. And, it's again, when you take on chair positions of these kinds of international accords, it's a lot of work. So, again, my hat's off to you. And I know one of the participants, Ken Takagaki, so I do get some feedback, and I know that's a lot of work.
Yeah, it's a fair amount of work, but I think it's worth it, and I was honored to be elected, and look forward to working with the organization.
So how can partnerships improve computing education?
Well, I mentioned earlier the importance of having input from diverse perspectives on almost any project, and certainly that applies to education in general and computing education specifically. Preparation for professional practice means preparation for functioning in a professional environment or context. So in that sense, it's important to have partnerships with companies that employ computing professionals, because this provides an important link with those who will hire the computing graduates and helps to keep a program, let's say, more relevant and more aware of needs for improvement and needs for remaining relevant. So it's important that both academics and industry representatives work together in order to achieve the best education for students. Also, I think it's important to have partnerships among organizations. I mentioned the joint work between the ACM and the IEEE Computer Society, which has been recognized pretty much around the world as establishing important recommendations for competing programs. The work through IFIP on an international level is really a partnership among a much larger group of organizations. But the IP3 work that you mentioned is also a partnership that brings in international computing companies as well as some professional organizations from various countries. So it all goes back to something that I said very early. It's related to the notion that diverse views and interests and contributions make for a stronger result. And so it's very important that we all work together and establish as many partnerships as we can in order to determine the best kind of education that we can provide.
And I'd like to add perhaps the facilitation of these processes and these programs and your leadership and your vision as well. And again, I think just a remarkable job, being involved, guiding or facilitating, as I indicated, these programs worldwide.
Well, it's not easy to establish partnerships. And, I've just in the U.S., I certainly have had more experience here, but for a long time, people in computing have been saying, we need to find ways to get industry involved, and it's so hard. And but it's happening, and I think it's a matter. It's like a lot of things. You need to make incremental progress, and many things take a long time, and you just take very small steps, and keep working and chipping away and making progress, and the end result can be quite good.
Joe, you're perfectly situated. I consider you the sort of the hub of this global ecosystem of knowledge in many ways, with all of the ties and linkages and positions that you hold. So if you could look into your crystal ball, can you provide some predictions of future trends and their implications and opportunities?
Well, thanks. I think you gave me a lot more credit than I deserved. Having observed the inaccuracy of most predictions of the future, certainly in computing, I try to avoid making any predictions. So I don't have any idea what the advances in technology really will be, but it seems obvious that computing and communication will continue to merge and become more ubiquitous and more cost-effective and all those kind of things. And all these advances will bring new opportunities and challenges for education. And I think computing is in a interesting and different position relative to these advances than almost all other disciplines, in the sense that we have to keep up with the technology and the technological advances in order to keep what we teach relevant and current. But like virtually all other areas, and education in general, we have to learn to adapt to use the technologies, and we have to recognize the impact and the implications of technologies on the way students think and the way they learn, and in particular, the way that changes with each new sort of wave or round of technology. Anybody who's taught recently, I think, has had experiences of the sort where you mention something, especially those of us who've been around for a little while, you mention something like you use a phonograph, a record, as in order to illustrate something, and you get this room full of blank stares from students who have no earthly idea what you're talking about. And then also there's the thing I mentioned earlier about things becoming so rapid, so instantaneous, constant communication, instant connection among each other and around the world and to information and everything else. And it just changes the whole way that students can think about issues and the way that they learn and what's effective and what is not effective. So I think those are really big challenges for education in general, and certainly for computing. And sometimes I think people in computing it takes longer for people in computing to learn to use the technology effectively, because often we're so focused on keeping our curriculum, our material, what we teach up to date and current and relevant relative to the technology, that we neglect to consider how we can use our own technology in an effective way. And then I mentioned earlier the proliferation of names for computing programs, and I certainly hope that trend will not continue and that we can work toward developing core knowledge and abilities that are needed for a small number of programs, and then we add or remove specializations or tracks in various emphasis areas as the need arises or as the need vanishes, rather than implementing new programs to focus on very narrow areas.
So what are your top recommended resources and why?
Well, certainly in general information, the publications and the conferences of the major computing societies are good resources in general, technical information as well as educational, because most societies do have major efforts involved in education, and they produce a lot of good materials that are relevant to good education. A major goal, of course, the reason for this is the major goal of the computing societies typically is the dissemination of current and relevant information. And conferences provide an opportunity for discussion and interaction among professionals with common interests and challenges. So it's often difficult to attend conferences, but I think it's an extremely valuable resource and complements the basic written materials that are available by providing the extra dimension of being able to interact with people who have similar interests and problems. It isn't something you can obtain from any specific source, but to me, the best resource for success in most any project is good people. There's just no substitute for good people. And the reason I mention that is that for most projects in volunteer organization, there's just no need to even start a project, regardless of how good it sounds, unless you have good, competent people working on it. You usually need a champion who is competent also, not only in the knowledge of the area, but in being able to lead and organize. And then you also need competent and conscientious volunteers working on it. So I think it's important. That's an important resource for volunteer, especially volunteer projects.
You know, we're down to our last couple of questions, and you know, you traveled a lot. You've been involved in a lot of different kinds of programs worldwide. So, do you have any sort of special stories to share?
Well, that's a little bit like your question of about writing things down. When people ask me about interesting situations or I've been in, I always have a hard time thinking of them because I guess it's out of context, and maybe I'm just not good at remembering things like that. But I can think of a couple of interesting things that have happened. One was, I remember once meeting a student. It was in an airport. I was passing through, and we both were, and it turns out that this student had actually taken a course, data structures, with me. I think it was three times in an attempt to achieve a satisfactory grade. Worked hard and just it was just one of those kind of frustrating cases. It wasn't clear why it just wasn't taking, but it, as I said, it took three times, but he persevered and actually got through and graduated And it turns out, in talking to him about what he was doing, he had become actually very successful with a well-known computing software company. And the interesting thing to me is, there are other similar situations or cases that I've become aware of through the years, but this one just really emphasized that it's not always the case that academic performance correlates completely, certainly, or at least necessarily highly, with professional performance. There are a lot of other things involved than just simply academic knowledge or academic performance. And these are things that mostly we don't make an attempt to, and I don't know whether we could if we even tried or not. We don't make any attempt to measure or evaluate, and I don't know that we should. But I just think it's interesting and it's important that we be reminded that there are a lot of things that make for successful contributors. And sometimes we tend to feel that simply making good grades in our courses provides that ability, but that's not always the case. Let's see, another one, sort of one of my favorite remembrances, is when I first went to the Middle East and I was teaching there. And I made the first assignment in class, and as the due date came, not many assignments came in, and immediately negotiation began in terms of delaying the due date, extending the due date. And of course that happens in the U.S. as well, but this, it was really different, the sort of level of intensity, I'll say, for extending the due date. And then when I returned the graded papers, there was an immediate effort to negotiate a higher grade. And these things took me a little bit by surprise. Fortunately, I didn't react in an angry way. But after I thought about it and talked to some people, the obvious thing, I guess, if you think about it, is that this was the culture. And negotiation was a standard part of the culture. And they were not trying to put anything over on me or anything like that. It was just the way that everything works in that culture is the negotiation is just a fact of life. On the other hand, once I made it clear that deadlines were deadlines and grades were grades and wouldn't be changed unless there was a mistake had been made or something like that, then that was accepted, and it basically never happened again. Again, part of the culture that if a rule is understood to really be a rule and is given by a person of authority, then that rule is accepted, and people operate in that environment. So I found that was one of the interesting experiences I had while I was there.
So I guess it ties into this idea that you talked about earlier about, you know, flexibility in your approach with cultures and people and so on.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And then one more experience I'll relate. This happened when I mentioned earlier about the efforts to achieve cooperation between the ACM and the IEEE Computer Society and in developing curriculum recommendations. And it was the first time we had tried that, and it got off to a bit of a rocky start, which was not unexpected. You know, anytime you have two different groups, you bring them together, there's a lack of trust and perhaps some suspicion on each side and lack of understanding about the positions of the other side. And so it had been a little bit of a rocky start, but things really came together during one of our early meetings, when we were at an estate that had been donated to a college and was used for retreat purposes. So we were the only ones there in this rather large house and spacious grounds. And so the our initial discussion started off not being with sort of carrying over the negative factors that had come out during an earlier meeting, and the suspicions and all sort of still existed. But then during a break, we started playing volleyball and croquet, and in volleyball, the rule was that you couldn't have a team. A team couldn't be, say, completely from one organization or the other. We had to have mixed things. And so it was just amazing to see the effect of that, what essentially turned out, I guess, would be called today a team-building activity, that just all of a sudden a lot of the animosities vanished, and we started joking and ribbing each other about some of the positions that had been taken. But these were brought up in a friendly and very collegial kind of manner, and it really had a remarkable change on the way that the group worked from that point on. So we don't often think about that, but these kind of activities of getting cooperation and the team building types of things can be extremely valuable, especially in situations where you have people with different kind of backgrounds and who haven't worked together previously. When you get them together, very important, though.
You know, Joe, those are great stories, because there's lessons in each one of them, so I know the audience will enjoy it.
Good.
Well, you know, we're down to our last question, and this is where I kind of turn the tables and say, you know, we covered a lot of areas, but if you were doing the interview, what questions would you ask, and then, you know, what would be your answers?
Well, you've definitely been thorough with your questions, so I can't think of anything that I would say really super important that's been omitted. A couple of things that come to mind. I might ask, why would anyone want to devote so much effort to volunteer professional activities? And I guess my answer to this is that I think we all have an obligation to contribute to making the world a better place. And one of the ways that we can do that is to contribute to the improvement of the profession that's basically provided us a lot of interesting challenges and a livelihood, for that matter. And that seems especially appropriate for a profession like computing that can improve the quality of life for so many people. So it's been very rewarding. I think it's just the answer to that, one answer to that. It can really be rewarding to be able to give something back to such a profession. Another related question might be, well, then should everyone try to be a volunteer in professional activities? And I guess, in general, my answer to all-encompassing questions would be not necessarily. That is, there's no absolute. There are very few absolutes or cases where everyone should do something. But the reason I say not necessarily is I think everyone should volunteer and contribute to something that's beneficial to society. Not everyone is in a position to do that, but I really think that everyone should try to do that. And certainly professional activities can be very beneficial. Requirements for success and advancement for early career professionals often, probably usually even, make it difficult and sometimes even detrimental to a career to devote significant time to volunteer activities. And that's unfortunate, but it's realistic. And so certainly it's the case that I think young professionals have to be very careful about getting too involved in things that are not going to contribute to basic success and advancement in their career. And the reason I say that's unfortunate is because quite often, early career professionals are where we get a lot of fresh and good ideas and perspectives on things. Sometimes I'm asked, should every computing program seek accreditation? Sort of completely different tack from the two previous questions. And again, my answer to that, as much for one thing, it's got every in it, and almost nothing applies to every. So I would say not necessarily. In particular, I think that every computing program that intends to produce graduates for entry into a computing profession should seek accreditation. But if doing so is not a primary goal of a program, then accreditation might not be appropriate. So again, it's a matter of context and the nature of the program and what the program is trying to accomplish. But I do think most programs would benefit from seeking accreditation. Similarly, or conversely, perhaps even, more programs that are accredited, the more meaningful accreditation becomes. A little bit strength in numbers, but lending recognition and for the process and for the fact that a program is accredited. And also being able to once becoming accredited, also allows a program to have a much better entry into participation and say and what accreditation involves and what its requirements are. So that's, I guess those are, you asked for three, and that was three.
Well, Joe, considering your schedule, and you know, you're involved with so many significant global efforts, and it's remarkable that you were able to take the time, and I really appreciate it, to come in and share some of your insights with us, you know, and we know that we will continue to follow your significant global and historical contributions. So really, thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with our audience.
It's been my pleasure, Stephen, and thank you for your work in producing these interviews.
Well, it's always a pleasure with you, Joe. So you're just doing so much, and let's continue to do these.
Thank you.
I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Dr. Joseph Turner, internationally awarded authority in computer science and education, fellow of the ACM, ABET, CSAB, chair of the Solo Accord, Vice President and Chair of the Publications Committee of IFIP, Chair of the Accreditation Council Training Committee for ABET, and Team Chair for ABET Computing Accreditation Evaluations.